As Steve said, we're here for this next hour to talk about Florida, really with hopefully what will be a very optimistic tone. I know that there have been challenges that we've all faced in the room, and especially our panelists. But hopefully after this hour, we'll walk out of here with a bit of pep in our step, so to speak, and that there is sort of a very positive outlook. I see Capel smiling, and so certainly that is the goal. So with that, let me just quickly introduce who is on the panel, because there are no better experts about Florida than we have Adam Schwabach. He is one of the senior brokers at Gallagher, and specifically, he works closely with Citizens to help broker the Citizens program. So certainly has a tremendous amount of insights. And then we have Jennifer Montero, the CFO of Citizens, and I'm sure you're all familiar with Citizens as an institution. And then we have Michael Stahel, who is a partner, the founding partner of LGT Partners, who is one of the largest investors in this asset class and has been around for as long as I can remember. And so, you know, I know that you had said originally, Michael, that this is what your investors pay you to take this type of risk. And so with that, my perspective is, you know, I am not an expert on Florida. So when Steve asked me to moderate it, what I really first started doing was jotting down just general questions. And when we had our planning session, I think that it was almost like a fireside chat. I'd like to have this as sort of an interactive session where I'm just going to throw out the questions that I had about is it dysfunctional? What makes it dysfunctional? How do we move it forward? And then let us all sort of bring the various points that we have. And I think that there's a lot of positive that will come from that. So don't be shy. Feel free to ask questions or chime in with a thought. And with that, maybe I'm just going to throw out some of the questions that at least I was thinking about. So the first question that I had is, why do we believe Florida functions differently than all other markets? Because that's certainly my perception, that when I say all other markets, all other global markets, there really isn't another market that functions similar to Florida. So that was my first question that I had. And then I had, what has been the historical challenges for Florida, really pre and post Ian? What do you believe needs to be done to create a well-functioning market? There's been a lot of recent legislation on both AOB, assignment of benefits, and attorney fees that have been recently passed by the Florida legislature. Do we believe that this will address some, if not all, of the current issues? And I guess this is near and dear to my heart. Alignment of interest has always been a hallmark to the development of the risk transfer market. Do you agree this is important, alignment of interest, and do you feel there's more work needed in Florida in this respect of alignment of interest? And so maybe with that, Adam, I'll open it up to you in alignment of interest.
Sure. And maybe this gets to some of the differences in Florida and what makes it so unique to start, but you know, I think going back historically, and we talked a lot about this and appreciate the historical panel, historical perspective the other panelists can provide, but Florida has been different really since Hurricane Andrew. And you know, that was one of those like earth-shattering, everybody's perspective on what potential risk they were taking in the state was turned upside down. And at that point in time, we saw a changing of the market. We saw national carriers pulling out. We saw the creation of what is, you know, what we call the domestic Florida insurance market, and that was completely necessary, right? We had to bring new capital into the state to take the risk that was no longer feasible for the national carriers to take. So that has worked, and that did work because there was an alignment of interest, from my perspective, in how the carriers and reinsurers were willing to share risk, right? There was a view that the carriers could operate companies, they can take operational risks, they can handle day-to-day claims, but they were going to be dependent on third-party reinsurance. They were going to be minimally capitalized, they were taking a tremendous amount of risk, and so for their capital providers, they needed to be able to make a return on that. That means that they were going to take more reinsurance risk, but they needed third-party reinsurers to take that risk. To the alignment of interest, I think that's really where we've seen the biggest separation in perspectives more recently. So what has historically been taking Florida cat risk, hurricane risk, reinsurers are finding that there's more risk that's seeped into that. There's operational components of what the companies are doing that no fault of their own, reinsurers are suddenly on the hook for. There are other perils that reinsurers, you know, never believed could be as bad, and some of that deals with, you know, litigation issues that have historically been in Florida that I think have caused a lot of those losses to get larger. But that's where we're seeing and we're hearing from reinsurers that there seems to be a combining of risk, and it makes things harder to price. They can't necessarily, we have very good cat models. They can price hurricane risk. But when you start to add in other factors for operational risk, other perils that are less modelable, litigation, which, you know, it's anybody's guess, you get a divergence in views very quickly, and that's very hard for ILS investors and any traditional reinsurer to explain to their investor base.
And thank you, Adam. And maybe, and I don't know if anybody has questions on that, because there's a lot there, because it is a fundamentally different market. And Jen, you know, you pointed out to me in our conversations sort of perhaps the volatile nature of some of these domestic companies. And, you know, you walked me through the amount of insolvencies, and we talked about rating. And so if maybe you can share with the audience some of your insights.
Sure. So to Adam's point, the national companies have left. Most of the companies are domestic companies. They're not very well capitalized. The requirements in Florida are lower for those companies to have capital. They do run on reinsurance is everything. So when the reinsurance market goes away, they don't have the capital to continue. So we had six insolvencies in 2022. We had two the year before, and we're expecting quite a few more for this year. So historically, the problems have been things like the one-way attorney fees, which just got fixed in the reform. Of course, it takes effect on new business and at renewal. So it takes about a year for all of those policies to run off into a new policy to follow those rules. But what that does is it stops those frivolous lawsuits, mm-hmm. the lawsuits that, and I'll back up, for those that don't know what one-way attorney fees, Florida,
that would be helpful.
How it works with property is if you sue your insurance company and the judge awards you 1 cent more than what the company offered you, the company must pay your legal fees. And so this was set up for the little old lady that doesn't understand in big bad insurance company, but what it turned to in Florida is fraud. They started with AOB with the vendors when water pipes broke.
And maybe explain what AOB is.
So the assignment of benefits, what would happen, your pipe breaks, you call somebody to come in and suck the water up, and he has you sign an assignment of benefit, like when you go to the doctor and you sign something that says, I'm going to work directly with your insurance company to get payment for your doctor. It kind of works the same way. They say, you can pay me $5,000 tonight because I just sucked up all this water. You just sign this assignment of benefit, which gives their rights away. So what happens is they are then buddies with their attorney friends, and the next thing you know, they're suing. And the policyholder sometimes doesn't even know that they're in a lawsuit. They're named in the lawsuit, but it's the vendor that has the assignment that is standing in their feet, in their shoes to sue the company. And they give ridiculous invoices, that things you don't cover, things that, you know, you decline it. Then they take you to court and you get awarded something. And then the next thing you know, where it's all to churn legal fees. It's been a problem for a long time because a lot of the legislature at the Capitol, they are funded by a lot of litigators. So it was hard to get this to happen. I think the politics just went right as DeSantis wanted to run for governor, and who knows if he wants to run for something else. He's really trying to get it fixed. We had, you know, Demotech was going to downgrade a bunch of companies all at once. That was a big deal. The governor, you know, put his foot in and said, oh gosh, we got to do something. So I think that's where we finally got the big reform that we've been asking for about 5 years at least, which is get rid of the one-way attorney fees and get rid of the AOB. And they did that for property. They unfortunately did not do it for auto. It was kind of removed. So we're already seeing the legal world moving to autos. So beware. That's probably next.
So I think, so going back to why does the market function differently is that this is a very unique market in that it had this historical AOB, the assignment of benefits, and the one-way attorney fees that you didn't have in other markets. And so that ties into what Adam was speaking about, sort of the alignment between these domestic companies taking the operating risk and reinsurers were taking cat risk. But because you had these two unique set of circumstances of AOB and one-way fees, as Jen said, there were a lot of legal fees generated, whether you want to call it fraud or not, but expenses that were not part of the model. And so I think that was what your point is, that started to bifurcate and why you saw certain counterparties exit the market.
Yeah, I mean, and let's not forget, too, I mean, I gloss over this, right? But, I mean, Florida's a little tiny peninsula that sits out in the most hurricane-prone part of the world. So, you know, I think it's something like 60% of the hurricanes, named storms, make landfall in Florida. So that exasperates all of this. As a born Minnesotan, this wasn't something I used to worry about. But after 15 years in Florida, you know, you start to get used to, like, okay, it's time to evacuate. Right. That's part of normal life.
You know, and Michael, something different to AOB and one-way fees that you had mentioned that gives you a little pause for concern, because you said this is what your investors pay you to do, is to take this risk, so you would like to. But there are other issues beyond just AOB and the one-way attorney fees that give you a little bit of pause for concern, too. So maybe you can articulate sort of those concerns that you have.
Absolutely. I think without wanting to be too philosophical right at the beginning, but right. we have a mandate from institutional investors to invest into event-driven investments, event-driven allocations. And hurricane event is one of those risks that our investors are, in fact, I would say, open to take if they're being compensated for taking the risk. And then on the other hand, you have the homeowners, maybe even corporates, that have a real asset in Florida, a big threat, not just for Minnesota, and also for a Swiss person, a big threat, and high values. That's another element. So clearly there is a lot of values that needs to be insured in and wants to be insured, a lot of risk that the homeowner doesn't want to take on his own book and want to carry on. And so here we are. That's the actual risk that we're willing to take, and that's the mandate that we have. But there is a lot of going on in between that we don't necessarily like. And as a result, we have always had a lower allocation to Florida than many of our peers, many of our competitors, for exactly these reasons. And to come to your question, so everything that has been discussed here, I would even argue if we can put down a number on the additional cost that we will incur of doing business in Florida, I guess then that would be easy. You just have to be paid for taking the risk. You just have to understand the risk. You have to be able to quantify the risk. You have to be able to raise a premium and get a premium for that. That would always work. Our key concern, and that's to the question, is that level of alignment of interest that you already alluded to. So we have a bit of an issue with the alignment of interest that we see between the insurance company we do business with and ultimately the reinsurance community. And let me elaborate. So the key issue that we see, and I've only come across this in Florida and only in Florida, can you set up a claims management company aside of your insurance company, have the claims management company manage the claims and charge the cost, the operating cost of running the claims back to the insurance company. And consequently, what you do is you transform operating cost into reinsurance recoverables. If I deal with, name any other company, Allianz in Germany, Allianz, they have their own claims department. If there is a big loss, and we've had a big loss in 2021 with the floods, the local floods in Germany, every single claim is managed in-house. And I'm not even saying that it's a quieter place than Florida. There are people that are not happy with the level Allianz has managed to claim. Don't quote me on this. I'm speaking in front of an audience here. Pick any other name. I'm not saying Allianz is a bad company. What I'm saying is that they run the claim in-house. So if they're being sued, they have their own lawyers, in-house lawyers, managing the claim. If they need external lawyers, they hire external lawyers, but that cost will be carried and borne by Allianz as part of their operating cost. So what I'm going to pay, if I back up Allianz as a reinsurance company somewhere in their reinsurance tower, I'm paying for the money that they actually paid out to the individual who lost their homes and nothing else. And so the operating cost is not assigned. And then these companies are even making money in a bad year. As a matter of fact, they probably make a lot of money in a bad year because they can charge all their operating costs back to reinsurance recovery. So that's misalignment of interest number one that we really don't appreciate. And the other one is maybe a bit more vague. We also feel there is a bit of a misalignment in how the business is being sourced. That's not specific only for Florida, I understand that. But again, using my example of Allianz, Allianz is selling every single policy that they sell it by their own Allianz agents. So the Allianz agents, they're hired and paid for by Allianz to sell an Allianz policy. And so they work for Allianz, which means, sorry, I should change the name, AXA. They work for AXA, which means they ultimately somehow represent the interests of the company they work for. Whereas if you have a third-party agent, the agent owns the client. So the business will go through to the insurance company that is probably paying the highest kickback by the highest share in commissions and probably asks the least questions. And maybe what we also keep hearing is that has the best technological interface. So it's even less work for the agent to get onboard the policy to that specific insurance company. And so you can easily grow in Florida and you can easily optimize the portfolio, which is also nice. I mean, let's face it, an Allianz client will hardly be kicked out of the Allianz portfolio one year to the other. But point again, we're asking ourselves, okay, where is the alignment of interest here? If you're that agent, what do you want? You want to maximize your own returns, and you want to ensure that your client stays with you. And so you will be fighting for your client. You will not be fighting for the insurance company you work for. So you can see there is some disalignment of interest here. And we feel that you can address that. I'm not even saying that it's just bad, and I'm not saying that we should revolutionize the market, but there should be maybe even a regulatory element of a proper oversight of how the agents are responding in such a scenario, how they're getting paid, how they're getting compensated, and maybe there should be clawback on the profitability of the portfolio that the agent is managing back from the insurance company in a year where clearly a certain portfolio has performed poorly.
All right. Well, this is a lot of doom and gloom that we've heard about the historical, but I don't think the goal is that Florida is just meant to be for rich homeowners, that there is change afoot. And there's a promise. I mean, everyone has touched upon it, but let's really discuss what the outlook is now with the recent legislative changes. I don't know, Jen, do you want, let's really sort of highlight these changes that have happened. Sure. There have been multiple changes and how we expect them to filter through.
So the biggest one for us, for everybody, I think, is the one-way attorney fees. So that goes away, which means if you sue somebody, you're paying your own legal fees. Companies no longer will pick up your legal fees. The assignment of benefit, that is gone. That was effective January 1st for property. Not for anything else specific about that. But so that's no longer a problem. Okay. And then they changed a few other things.
Shortening the duration.
The duration. So it was, if you remember, 5 years that people could file a claim, which I had a conversation with Ricky earlier. He couldn't believe 5 years, right, people still come and file a claim, like you don't know you have a claim.
Right.
It's probably fraud after year 4, 3, 2.
Yeah.
Six months.
Yeah, exactly.
But so they went from 5, then they made it 3, and now then last special session, I think it was 2, and they've now made it 1 year. Unfortunately, that's at new business or renewal. Who's ever written now still gets their 2, but it's going to 1. So that's great. That gets rid of a lot of fraud, and people just get it in, get it taken care of, get it paid. I think that will help out on the LAE costs and the indemnity costs on both of those. So those are good. We do have to also adjust the claim sooner. We had 90 days, now we have 60. So what happens if you get a partial payment and or you don't have a payment at all, within the first 60 days, the payments that you'll receive after that will have interest associated with them. We were already doing that in Florida for anything that went over 90 days. The FORA program, which is the Florida Optional Reinsurance
Assistance.
Is it arrangement?
We've got a lot of acronyms.
Citizens is not allowed to participate in this. Okay. But it's similar kind of to the wrap that the special session did last time, where they had a mandatory layer below the cap fund, and it was free. And everybody had to take it either last year, or if they didn't take it last year, they had to take it this year. So what FORA does, it says, it's right next to that wrap layer and says, if you took the wrap layer last year, you can't do it this year. And if you didn't, you have to take wrap. So for those that can't get wrap this year, you can get FORA. The difference is it's optional. That's the first thing. And it has a charge. And the three, there's three and then a fourth layer. The fourth layer everybody can use, but the three layers. And they range from 50 to 55%, 60 and 65% rate online. So they're steep. They're, okay. they're not cheap. Very different than having a free layer. So the industry's had some issues with that. They don't think it's too expensive. It still leaves $5.7 billion of retention before anything kicks in. So and there's not a market. We are not seeing big markets that will cover that. So they are looking at ways to tweak that.
Can I just jump in? Because you should also hit on the citizens changes, which are big. Oh, yeah. But maybe before that, I mean, all of those changes that Jennifer just described, I think the good news for this group is those are all extremely beneficial for reinsurers and risk takers. I mean, if you talk about pulling one-way attorney fees and AOB out of the claims process, ultimately, in a hurricane, those charges and those losses are being passed on to risk capital that sits behind these carriers. And I think that's a huge point to make. What the industry experienced with Hurricane Irma, I think, was kind of the groundswell, like, wake-up call for the market to say, we thought we trusted models. A year out, we thought we had a good loss. And then 2 years out, we thought we had a good loss. And then three, I mean, the Irma just kept developing. And all of these additional litigation losses were being passed on to reinsurers. And I think that was a huge separation from the reinsurance market saying, this is something I can underwrite, versus saying, I don't even know how I can price for this anymore. The one year reporting period is huge, for especially for those in this room, right? I mean, you talk about trapped collateral. You're going to get to a point much sooner in the claims process where you know what your ultimate loss is going to be for both the carrier and the reinsurer, and you can then redeploy that risk. So I think that there was definitely a realization with these changes that were made that fundamentally reinsurance does drive the property cat market in Florida. The carriers absolutely need it, and these changes were put into to address that. Now, the reinsurance, the optional reinsurance program that Jennifer described, the wrap layer from last year, you know, ongoing conversations that are still being had to maybe do more there. I think there's also a realization that right now it's going to be hard to convince reinsurers that all of these changes are going to have an immediate impact. I mean, from my perspective and those that I've talked to, they are like life-changing, game changers, things that people never thought would go away. I mean, taking away the one-way attorney fee statute, I don't think anybody thought was possible, and suddenly it's off the table. So it will have a massive impact, but I think, talking to the traditional reinsurers and ILS markets, there's going to need to be a period of proving the benefit of that before people really jump back in.
Yeah, and there's, I'm sure you've heard this before, I think our former commissioner said it, Florida has the litigation.
87%.
We have 7% of the losses, but 87% of litigation, and that's a national number. So we have 7% from a national, but 87% on litigation. That's how bad that it's been. So hopefully that will change.
And so ultimately the question is, can you price this risk? Do you feel comfortable? Like, so, Michael, with these changes that have been discussed, do you feel that, models are models, but that you can rely on the risk probabilities to price something? Because if you don't know how much risk you're taking, you can't price it. Do you feel that this sort of ring fences your risk a bit more and that you can price this? Are you optimistic?
We are very optimistic, I have to say. Maybe I'm a bit too negative on Florida as a market. And we're sitting up here. We've always supported the Citizens Placement in the past. Mm-hmm. We view this as a bit of a market placement. So it's a matter of fact, especially for the ILS market and for capital market investors, that was an easy access to a large portfolio this year, more than ever. And so that helps. And certainly, yes, all of these measures, we take a close watch on all these improvements. In the past, what we've simply done, is we have, in order to underwrite Florida business, we have added a factor for the uncertainty. And that factor will be, hopefully, we can reduce that over time. Because all we have to do is we have to factor in an additional loss cost for the Florida challenges.
Right.
And as these challenges are getting smaller, of course, it's hard to prove it. I'm not saying it takes another hurricane, because no one wants another hurricane, but over time we will see how that really plays out. But we have great hopes that all of these measures are mm-hmm. making the market more stable, and especially the point that Adam mentioned is the development, this adverse development that we have seen on Irma was extremely undesirable for our investors. Because how can you explain to an investor that you following the reserves of the original counterparty and then 2 years later, you still increase the reserve level for that loss that happened 2 years ago? And that's a true game changer. I think there you can really use that word, the game changer, is the 12-month cap. That's extremely helpful because, okay, there could still be,
right.
not saying that we have to find a number after 12 months, but at least we know the count and you can have a better handle on the actual loss level.
And Jennifer, Citizens, your ultimate goal, though, as I understand it, is you'd like to depopulate. You know, if Citizens could shrink and go away, that would be, you know, a wonderful situation. So do we think that with these new changes, all these changes, not just bringing existing investors in, but do we think that there'll be more domestics, new startups, that can actually make money in this space to help us? And I think that would encourage the market as a whole.
Absolutely. So some of the changes that were specific to us. So we react to the market. When the market is healthy, we're very small. Right. And you only come to us because you can't find coverage. When the market's not healthy, like it is now, we grow. So we were 420,000 policies less than 3 years ago, and we're 1.17 million today. And we've forecasted to be 1.4 million by the end of this year. So one of the problems that we had is we're here because policyholders don't have a place to go, but because our rates have been capped since 2011, we're cheap. So now you're in, how do I get you out?
Right.
So we have some eligibility things. One of them is our clearinghouse. You go through the clearinghouse as new business. If you get another offer from anyone in that clearinghouse, then you're not, that's within 20% of Citizens premium, you're not eligible. So, but at renewal, you just had to be equal to, you had to have an offer equal to or less than Citizens to not be eligible. Right. So no one left. So Depop's helpful.
Okay.
The new reform did change, so that now on renewal, if you have an offer 20% within 20%, you're not eligible. You go, so that pushes it back into the market. But if they're getting offers, the market should be healthy.
Right.
That's the whole point. Depop is great. We think we expect a lot of Depop because the policies that we have right now are healthy policies. They're good policies. They're just policies that other people just shed because of exposure. So we do see when we get big like this, and you can cherry pick. If anyone ever wants to depop, come and pick whatever you want. It works well, but they'll, because of this reform is brand new, I think they're gonna wait till after the season. Take them October, November, December are big months. October makes me a little nervous because the wind still blows.
Right.
But if they take policies out then and they don't, we service them and they take them, we don't withhold a ceding commission anymore. So they get all this unearned premium. Then they have 6 months to earn it out so that they can buy reinsurance. So we see new companies have a plan. I think that's a lot of them want to do that. But one of the things is that's negative is the takeout rate's 15%. So you and it's really due to the agents being educated by these new companies or these domestics that are not maybe have a reputation of not being well capitalized. They'll get an offer and their agent will be like, you don't want to go to that company. Or, yeah, we don't know them, they're brand new, don't go there. Stay as Citizens because they'll pay your claim. And so part of that legislation that changed that eligibility is now for Depop. So if a Depop company comes in and picks your policy and it's within 20% of Citizens policy, we're going to non-renew you. You don't have to go to that Depop company, but you can't stay with us. So we're trying to use ways that using the premium being next to ours, because that says whether or not the market is healthy enough if you're getting offers to then get them out. Another thing that we had done is they changed our rate language to be back to what it was like before 2006, which said that we had to be actually sound and non-competitive with the admitted market. So that's great, but then it says within the glide path. So there's a little niche there. So our glide path was 10 for since 2011, 12, and then recently it went up to 11 last year, 12 this year, and it'll go all the way up to 15 in 2026. So we're getting a little bit of a 1%. So the non-competitive will help because then we just do a flat 12%.
Right.
And at least get that because we're not getting that. So there have been a lot of things that I think will be helpful. It'll help keep citizens small when the market is healthy. And I think having the one-way attorney fees gone and AOB gone, I think that will be very helpful for the markets that are there and more so for brand new markets.
Right. Yeah. And so that's what I want to ask you, Anna. Are you hearing about brand new markets? Do you see private equity? Do we see capital flowing in to take advantage of all these changes?
Yeah, I think I would say I've never seen the amount of activity that there is going on right now in that space. I mean, I finally had to start writing down a list of the new carriers that were saying that they were going to start.
It wasn't one or
two. So, you know, it's you're probably talking about, you know, 12 to 20 groups that are out there actively raising money right now saying this is the right time to get into Florida, with the caveat being their biggest question mark right now. They look at it and say these reforms are phenomenal. We think rates are going to trend down. We can handle the cat risk. Is there reinsurance? That's the million-dollar question right now that every new carrier says. Can we get the reinsurance that we need? So that remains a question mark. But I mean, outside investors, once they can get over the headlines, and that's going to take a solid management team to help them understand. You know, you read the headlines, it does look like doom and gloom. Six carriers went out of business last year. You know, there's hurricane risk, but the right management team can definitely explain that to investors to show here's the opportunity, which is sizable and pretty attractive. So we do definitely expect there to be new carriers. I mean, there was one that started in December of this last year that we're working with. There are others that would absolutely love to be up and running even before this wind season. But like I said, the million-dollar question is, where's the reinsurance?
And we do, I will say, I think, not we, that at least 3 to 5 companies are not going to make it. And they're just not. No matter what kind of help, they should have been out of the game a while ago.
Okay.
And Band-Aids after Band-Aids after Band-Aids aren't going to help. So there's a part of the market that needs to just...
to shake out.
But here's a question from my end then. So when do you think there will be a time when the big nationwide carriers are coming back to Florida with actual names?
No.
I don't think we'll ever see it.
Never.
No.
And why?
So my perspective, I mean, this is just me reading the tea leaves, right? Yeah. Nobody's told me this, but I would say, you know, people are pointing to this right now saying, look how great things are. But we've been through market cycles before. I mean, there were companies that were, it was a great environment, 2014, 2015. That's when we saw the last run of startups within the state. That didn't attract any of the national carriers back. And, you know, this was a comment made by somebody much smarter than me last night that said, you know, those national carriers are also dealing with issues in other lines of business right now. So homeowners used to be, you know, something that went along with maybe an auto book or something like that. Where now, you know, maybe it's not quite as, that book isn't running as well. So are they really at that point willing to then look at going back into something as volatile as Florida? And I would say, if anything, that volatility has proven for them and what they're worried about, that they were probably right not to be in this market. I could be wrong. They may, you know.
And they do have their little pups of, you know, the Castle Key and those guys. They've got a little bit of...
disguise.
Yeah, they're disguised nationals that are tiny and they're like, okay, we'll put this here. That way if it doesn't work out, it's not touching my nationwide type company. So they do have some pups in there, but there's not a whole lot. But I don't think we're going to get, I think if they were going to grow, it would be through one of those.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're going to come back like they were before Ian, or not Ian, sorry, before Andrew.
I don't think so, but I think there's a different question there, right? It's not necessarily that you need those national carriers either. There's probably just capabilities that you would rather see the current market have. And, you know, maybe I'm just closer to it than some in this room, but I would say the evolution of the Florida domestics over the past 15 years shouldn't be discounted. I mean, when I first moved to Florida, it was exactly what you all thought it was, right? It was maybe four guys and gals in an office working together and outsourced everything. And, you know, it was like, you're in charge of this vendor, you're in charge of this vendor. We got it all covered, right? Now these carriers, I mean, they're 200, 300, 400 people. You know, they're doing underwriting. They've got cap models internally. They have internal reinsurance buying teams in many instances, right? Some of them are starting to bring claims in-house, to your point. So not just day-to-day claims, but, you know, does it make sense to build out a cap response team? there's costs that go into that, but I think people can definitely see the value in having those types of capabilities. So I think rather than suggesting that we need the national carriers to come back into the state, I think what we need to do is see further improvement in the markets, and there's a separation. To Jennifer's point, I think that will be the difference between some making it and some not. Those that are really willing to invest in their company and grow their capabilities, they're going to survive this.
In their capital requirements are less. So after 04, 05, 8 storms, you know, nobody was here. And we had these startup companies, mm-hmm. these domestics, but they couldn't come up with the same capital that everybody else can. So the standards got lowered in Florida so that you didn't have to have as much surplus to start a company. You didn't have to have as much of this or that. And, you know, we couldn't get AM Best to rate them, you know. So they called Demotech, said, hey, can you come help us? We got these companies. We need somebody to rate them and get them going. And the problem is that's what that minimum requirement is kind of like their goal. It should be way higher. They're struggling. I mean, they can barely get to stay at that level. You know, they're going through.
So what will make that change?
Well, I would like to see the requirements for startups in Florida have to have a lot more.
And is that on the table?
Probably not. They can't get capital.
There's a change from the investors, though, as well. I mean, I would tell you the groups that we've talked to, I've had people tell me, you know, we want to raise $250 million and start a Florida carrier. And there's like that pause, like, well, why? That's so different, right? But I mean, I think that there is a perspective from some investors out there that have looked at the carriers and realized that they are running at the razor's edge when they're operating this way,
yes.
Right? I mean, leverage works both ways when you're thinly capitalized. So when times are good, the returns look great, but it doesn't take much to go the other direction. So we may see that. That may be something that investors would prefer to see. It does reduce short-term returns, but it does create a longer-term business.
I mean, ultimately, if all these changes that we've discussed truly bear out, people will flock to where they can make money. And so if the markets bear out after losses that you don't have all this fraud or all these dripping expenses, all the LAE, that I think that you will see the capacity. I mean, Michael, would you, you know, if the market proves itself out, do you see, you explained that you were underweight Florida at the start. Can you see that changing over time? Would you like to see that change over time, that underweight position?
Absolutely. If we can take the clean-cut hurricane exposure, where the sum of the loss that we see is the actual sum of the loss that residential homeowners occur, mm-hmm. obviously there will be some cost associated between, but if you can clean up the middle part, absolutely. And I think it's a difficult area in terms of also just event activity, but I have seen some of the you've mentioned that all these companies that went out of business over the last, say, 18 months. A lot of that happened before Hurricane Ian. So a lot of those mm-hmm. companies went out of business because their attritional losses and the cost killed them. It was not because there was a big event. And so I think what we really need is a healthy market with healthy companies. At best, probably you don't have much business at all anymore. That would be probably the perfect situation for all of us, right?
It's a great point, though. I mean, we haven't seen a company go out of business because of a hurricane in Florida in really since Andrew time period, right? Maybe you could say some developed into going outside the top of their tower, but that takes years. Most of what's killing the companies in Florida is attritional losses and death by 1,000 paper cuts. So
yeah, not being.
But those losses we don't take. So at least,
yep. I mean, that's fine.
Right.
Yeah.
No.
I'm an observer there. Yep. I come in at an occurrence level where it's really down to a single hurricane event.
And then they can't recapitalize. They can't get after the fourth, fifth time.
Right. But with all these changes, it will make the operating side profitable. There
Absolutely.
Will be money. You won't have
yep.
these attritional losses. I mean, I'm stating this as a fact, but certainly that is the goal.
That
and
is
then
the goal.
The capacity providers, the Michael Stahels of the world, can take the I mean, you can't price something unless you know how much risk you're taking. And if you can truly bifurcate, the operating providers know that they can make real margins, then they'll have a robust long-term. I mean, or, you know, I would think that would be, you know, certainly the goal. So
I think we'll see it very quickly on the attritional loss ratio side for the carriers, right? They're going to get the benefit of a lot of this legislation quick. I liken it to, you know, the state years ago had to pass legislation because there was a sinkhole problem, and suddenly the ground firmed up. It's like, you know, the earth was listening to the legislation.
And every one of those takes like 4 or 5 years
to
go through the legislation. You try.
But I have a feeling this will be a scenario where the legislation that was passed is going to help, you know, all of these severe convective storm losses that we've seen. I mean, we aren't getting more tornadoes and thunderstorms in Florida, but it became a market for roofers and lawyers to go make money. So those things will start to show up very quickly. I hope it doesn't take an event, like you said, Michael. You know, that could be the result, that we do need to see this play out in a hurricane. But I think we'll see the results faster on the primary side, and then it will be hopefully something that reinsurers can put into their pricing models.
That's a very good point. So what you say is that over time we should see that these companies are getting healthier. They run high surpluses and they can grow. And I guess that's ultimately what we want. We want to have, when we do due diligence on a counterparty, back to your comments around, you know, the four people in an apartment somewhere in Tampa.
Yeah.
We would never have supported it anyway, but now it's 200, 300 people, but they need money to keep running. And the worst that could happen is that in a big event, the company is running out of money to run their operations and is, you know, falling. That's the last thing we want. So clearly our due diligence and our focus is how robust is the company set up. And yeah, if you could have a couple of years with solid returns for all these companies, that would of course be positive for the market.
All right. So my takeaway is that the market, that it looks bright, that our future looks bright.
It does.
Let's keep our fingers crossed that it all plays the way we hope it will and the way it's intended. And I think with that upbeat note, open it up to any questions or comments. Oh. All right.
Thanks, Katie.
Matt.
So, you know, it's great that we fixed the sinkhole. It's great that we fixed the sinkhole problem. It's great that we're fixing the AOB and the one-way attorney's fees. But like Jennifer said, you have a lot of very smart, innovative people who see an opportunity to arbitrage the system and are figuring out ways to do it. So I'd be curious to know, you know, what's the next shoe as you see it, to the extent you can see it. We've gotten better, but, you know, we're not out of the woods, and there's always going to be somebody figuring out, you know, a way to make money. Make some fast money.
I mean, we might have new business plans if we can figure out what they're going to do ahead of time, unfortunately. There's the joke, right? Jennifer, we say this all the time, that Florida's like whack-a-mole, right? I mean, it's like you fix one problem and another one pops up. It is hard to see, though, right now. I mean, statutory change changes everything. And, like, this one-way attorney fee statute has been abused through many different cycles of loss that I think is going to be a much bigger deal than people think. There will always be issues. I mean, I've lived in Florida long enough to see that. I remember when I first moved down there, the big problem was tile floors, and people were dropping bowling balls on tile floors, and you had to replace the whole thing. And that was something, and then went to tile roofs. I mean, it will change. I do think, though, the large capability of this, and really to have it impact cat risk and the reinsurers and investors in this room, has been greatly reduced by this. It's difficult for me to see an opportunity for the bad actors to find a new way to lever up cat loss. That I think has hopefully gone away a fair bit.
Yeah. I saw Andre first, so I apologize. So Andre. It's hard to see.
Yeah, it's very bright up here. You can't see anything.
The problem as I see it in Florida, and, you know, I want to be optimistic, but, you know, a part of me is a bit like Michael, you know, in terms of being cautiously optimistic as to all those changes. And we all know there's going to be dampening factors, and people are going to find way to commit fraud because that's just, you know, part of the psyche or the collective, at least in Florida, being a part-time resident there. But the reality is, if you think of Florida in terms of, aside from the underwriting risk, right, you obviously have the regulatory risk, and, you know, Jennifer mentioned how, you know, rates get artificially depressed when we actually need to take rate increases. The fact that, you know, we'll see what happens with the new legislative changes. But, you know, I know we touched a bit on the operational side and how a lot of insurance companies in Florida are, you know, almost glorified MGAs, you know, operating separately. And how do we as the risk transfer market have the ability to piggyback on some of those fees that are taking out of the underwriting risk for them to share in the suffering? But okay, having said all of that, my question is, you know, way back, I remember, you know, in the olden days, how RenRe had supported Tower Hill, for example, and provided capital and of course benefited from getting some reinsurance. We've seen last year Vantage actually partner again with RenRe on the exchange they did for Tower Hill. Do you think that there's room, since we're talking about investors and we're talking about ILS, do you think there's rooms to create for investors or for primary market or even for ILS investors to create their own insurance companies, right, and benefit from the well-priced reinsurance risk and outsource the attritional, which is usually easier to deal with? Do you think this is something that we're going to see as a business model at some point?
I mean, I can start and anybody else can jump in, but I would tell you, you know, we'll structure a gross quota share for whoever wants it, right? I mean, you can take all of that risk from day one. I think that there will be plenty of opportunities for smart investors to find ways to partner with people in Florida, whether that's reinsurance, whether that's debt, whether that's equity. There's a number of opportunities available. I don't know.
Well, I'm 100% agree on most of your comments. We've had meetings, presentations around reinsurance programs where we looked at a company and said, actually, I probably should buy into your private equity, you should buy the share, because what you buy on top is going to protect me and only me. And so the only real deal that I see here would be to go into the company as a company and not necessarily look at the reinsurance part. Fortunately, on our behalf, that is currently not part of our mandate. And so when we look at these companies, in many cases, it's not just for Florida. That happens in a variety of regions and with a variety of risks. We view the different structures that we see, how we can support and how we can. It's all about insurance risk. It's about event-driven insurance risk. But how can we structure this? Fortunately, some of the funds that we manage are not open for regulatory reason to engage into such untraded, marked type of allocations. And as a matter of fact, we're currently working on, together with our colleagues from the private equity team, to see if we can do something more on the private equity side where we can, not driven by the Florida market as such now, but where we can do exactly what you've just described. Say, okay, what is the most attractive piece of that company? Is it really that cap bond up there? Is it that reinsurance placement up there? Is it maybe the debt piece? Although debt there, I'm very negative currently, because I feel that's probably the worst play that you can do. So it's really down then to the equity piece, where you say, okay, this is at times the most attractive play. But again, so the answer would be, unfortunately right now, for many of us, and I think I do speak for the broader ILS community, the mandate is very restrictive.
Thank you very much. Jennifer, there's been some media coverage of the latest provisions in that Florida session having to do with citizens mandating or ensuring that policyholders have a flood insurance. Would you kindly comment on that?
Sure.
And whether you think that will somehow help in a wind versus water debacle that happens after every event?
Sure. So what the reform said is that if you have a citizen's policy with wind, then to be eligible for citizens, you must procure a flood insurance. Not from us. We don't do flood. In fact, our statute says we're prohibited from doing it. But they could go to the NFIP or a private carrier and get flood. It's a stair step. So those in the areas, the zones that are designated as flood zones, they are mandated to do it first. So they have to have flood insurance by April 1st, 2023 for new business and July 1st, 2023 for renewals. And then it looks at the coverage amount for everybody else that's not in the flood zone. So if your home is $600,000 or more, you have to have it by January 1st, 24. If it's 500 or more, then it's January 1, 2025. And then 4,000 more, 3,000 more, goes all the way down to 27. And in 28, if you didn't fall into, well, for whatever reason, if you didn't fall in those buckets, everybody has to have it by January 1st, 2028. I think it's 28. It's either 27. I don't have it in front of me. I'm trying to go off memory here. So what I actually talked to the House staff that wrote this, and I said, why are you requiring this? Because not everybody's in a flood zone. And his response to me was Hurricane Ian and Orlando. Orlando's in the middle of the state. It's not in a flood zone, and the whole city's flooded with Ian. Mm. And I was also told at PCI, talking to a reinsurer, that FEMA had told them that 50% of all the flood zone policies in Florida, only 50% of them actually have a flood policy. The other 50 are going bare. So it is a big difference when you get the flood versus that's a big insurance thing. Which one? Is it wind or is it water? If it's a clean slab and the house is gone, I think everybody kind of took the same road and just paid policy limits because you can't prove one way or the other. And normally it goes to an engineer, and an engineer would, you know, go through that and figure it out. But I think you're less likely to have litigation if you also have the flood, and I think that's what they're looking at. So that's exactly why they wanted to do that.
All right, Niraj, I think this is, Steve, our last question. Niraj.
Thank you. Thank you, Judy. So I'm just following up on the comments you made about flood insurance. If they have difficulty getting a hurricane insurance and they are coming to Citizens, why would they be able to get flood insurance from a private sources? I mean, that doesn't make sense. And secondly, if you have two different parties are providing the cover, wouldn't there be still problems from the perspective of who pays for what?
So to answer the first question, my understanding is that it can be purchased through the NFIP or through a private carrier if they have it. The private carrier can give them larger limits. It says that if they have those larger limits, their limits should match what Citizens' coverage is.
I see.
We know the NFIP is only $250,000. That's their limit. So it says but if that's the only thing that they can get, then the statute says that's sufficient. And again, this is an eligibility issue, which makes it has some teeth in it. So a really bad example is you have flood insurance, you write your policy, you let your flood policy lapse, your house burns down. We say, oh, you don't have a flood policy, you're ineligible. You're not supposed to be a citizen. So, you know, we're still working on the logistics of it. I know that there are others that are trying to tweak some of that. Condo associations are big on that. Why does somebody on the 38th floor of an apartment need to have flood insurance? So there are, all of this is great, but it came out with, you know, kinks that you have to work through. And I'm sorry, what was the second question?
Oh, I'm going to sneak in another question. Which is that if you had your wish list, you know, Michael, you and Jennifer, what other changes would you like to see in the Florida market other than the ones you already discussed, alignment of interest, including
selfishly,
auto?
Selfishly, I would say get rid of our glide path. Let us be like we used to be. Citizens of Louisiana uses our model, and it works great. You know, we had to go look at the top 20. We had to be higher than everybody because it kept people out unless they really needed to be there. And that's what a residual market is. You're supposed to be. And we've had a lot of people stay a little bit longer than they really need to sometimes. Not this market, not so much, I think. But it's getting them out when the market gets healthy.
And that changes the market overnight, right? I mean, that takes that pricing ceiling completely off the table.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And then our rates would go.
For everybody, though. I mean, you know, people are competing against.
So. And we tried to do that on the non-residential. So if your home is, whether it's a tenant or the homeowner lives in it less than 9 months, it's considered non-residential. So for the non-residential, we did take off the glide path. However, we were so worried. Our actuaries looked at it and said these could be huge hits to people. So we did kind of cap that with 50%. So if you had a $100 policy, and it's your primary, your increase would be 12%. Now you have 112. If it's a non-primary, then it would be 150. You go from 100 to 150. So we don't want to, maximum is at 50%, but we'll get there a year or two. So that we're at least getting some of our business out from the glide path.
And so just to add to that, on my wish list, the biggest element of my wish list, I keep coming back to my very first comment, is that this external claims management company element, that should go away. And I hear what you say. Of course, it's not worth, it's not viable for a company to build up a claims team to manage the loss amount from a hurricane, which hopefully will never, ever happen, right? But my point is it should be part of the operational cost. And the regulator should ask for the corresponding equity element and then funding to live through such a big event and being able to pay for external legal advice, but it's an operational cost. I'm not paying for this. Right. I don't see why I should pay for this.
I will say we see both, right? So there are some exactly as you described, third party, internal, owned by the carrier. You're going to see, you probably don't like that model. And then we do see companies that are building their own, and there's a significant cost to that. I mean, I've had one client tell me he spends $4 million a year, whether or not the wind blows or not, but he's willing to do that. And you know, at the end of the day, reinsurers have a lot of say in who they support, so you can probably get some business plans changed.
We have a 50-50. It's all the claims people, all management's claims people. I think we have like 450 claims people. But then when you have a big storm, we use the independent adjusters that go out there, but it all goes up through the employee. But that's just because we don't have enough people.
That's Florida.
Yeah, it's Florida. We have 1,400 employees. And big chunk of it is claims and underwriting.
All right. Well, hopefully we've ended this session on a little bit more of a positive note than when we started, that at least these changes that we've discussed are leading in the right direction. Is it totally perfect? No. Niraj, we hear the wish list. But I think it's certainly a step in the right direction. And I really thank you, Adam, Jennifer, Michael, for contributing to this invaluable knowledge. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.